The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture entitled Constantine and the Spread of Christianity, the spread and acceptance of Christianity throughout the Roman Empire and its effect on the Jews, is dedicated to the memory and Le'ilu Nishmas Ben Sion Ben Yitzchok Olav HaSholem, Mr. Dennis Aaron of blessed memory.
According to the Talmud, one of the major and longest-running themes of Jewish history is the continuing struggle between the two brothers, Jacob and Esau, Yaakov and Esau. As you all know, Rivka, Rebecca, the wife of Yitzchok, Isaac, who finally became pregnant after almost 20 years of marriage, experienced great difficulty in her pregnancy. According to the Medrash, it wasn't just physical distress that she was experiencing, but psychological distress as well. Every time she would pass a Beis Medrash, a house of study, she would feel as if the baby was struggling to leave and enter the house of study. When she passed the Beis Avodah Zorah, a pagan house of worship, she would have the same feeling. It was as if the child in her womb had a split personality. The child struggling within itself, attracted to paganism, attracted to monotheism, with no single sense of direction and purpose. She went to seek divine guidance. In scripture itself, it's not explicit what the source of that guidance was. According to the Medrash, she went to Shem, the son of Noach, was the survivor of the flood. He told her that she had not one, but actually two sons, each destined to take a very different path in life, hence the attraction, the opposite attractions. One would be attracted to the world of the Beis Medrash of the yeshiva, this was Yaakov. The other attracted to an entirely different world, that was Esav. In addition, it was revealed to her that the physical stress that she was feeling was created by a struggle between the two brothers that was taking place in the womb. That initial struggle was symbolic of the struggle between these two brothers that would continue on for all eternity. Jacob became the father of the Jewish people. Esav, his brother, founded the nation of Edom to the south of Israel. Two nations locked into a struggle for supremacy. Defeated time and again by successive Jewish kings, David, Jehoram, Amatzia, and subdued through much of the Second Temple period. Edom, or Edomia, was known as it was later known, even after being defeated, and eventually was forcibly converted to Judaism by the Maccabee king Yochanan Hyrcanus, eventually rose to a position of power as predicted by the oracle, by the prophet. The prophecy was they would struggle. Always there would be one who would have the supreme position, but it would be changing. And finally dominated the Jewish people. This occurred when Antipater, the Edomian advisor to the Maccabee king Hyrcanus, this is, we've discussed this at length in a previous lecture, displaced his master and put into power his son Herod, who eventually created a dynasty of kings that ruled over the Jews. At the same time as the Herodians, these Edomians, became the kings over the Jews, the Romans, who according to the Talmud were at least partially descended from Esav, gained dominance over the Jews, eventually supplanting the Herodian puppet kings that they installed, and imposed an unbearable rule that led to revolt, bloodshed, and the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the temple. And it caused an increased dispersion of Jews throughout the world. In the ensuing years after the destruction of the temple, the Romans gradually adopted a religion that ensured that the largely, narrowly, politically based hatred that had been fanned against Jews would now take on religious dimensions, allowing it to spread out throughout the world to nations never actually had any contact with the Jews, or even previously heard the name Jew. According to Christian theology, the Jews who had previously been chosen amongst all nations to bear God's message and covenant now became rejected and hated. The message of the increasingly popular Christian church was love your neighbor, but hate the Jew. I'd just like to summarize this section. As we all know, Rebecca, Isaac, Rivka, Yitzchok had two children. Went into different directions. Esav became the father of the Edomians, became the father of the Romans. The Romans, according to Talmudic traditions, were descended partially. This is from Esav. So here we have the Edomians from the south. This is the Romans from the west. All descendants of Esav, who eventually, in the middle of the Second Temple period, dominated the Jews. The Edomians' domination was short-lived. It was the last some 100 years before the destruction of the temple. The Roman domination lasted much longer. First, as part of the Roman Empire, and secondly, as part of the church that they created that dominated Western Europe and Eastern Europe to this day. The year 313 marks a turning point in Christian and Jewish history. The Christian church that grew throughout the Roman Empire, despite official intolerance and persecution, became officially tolerated, with the Roman Emperor Constantine its greatest benefactor. After defeating his rival and gaining complete control of the Western Roman Empire, there are two parts, due to what he interpreted as the hand of the Christian God, they went to war, actually, with a symbol of Christianity. They had the like an acronym. There are two letters representing their belief in Christianity, and they won. And he interpreted it as a sign that their God, the Christian God, is the true God. Constantine, after his victory, together with the emperor of the Eastern Empire, Licinius, as the Eastern Empire, Palestine, and as Eretz Yisrael was part of that Eastern Empire, issued in the year 313 what is now known as the Milan Edict, granting official tolerance of all religious groups, and restitutions of wrongs done to the Christians. So now officially Christianity was tolerated, and in fact they were ready to make amends. In addition, Constantine himself made lavish, of his own monies, made lavish contributions to the churches and granted immunities of taxation to the clergy. After defeating Licinius in the year 324 and gaining control over the entire Roman Empire, east and west, Constantine began solidifying Christianity's hold over the Roman Empire by calling upon all its citizens to adopt the Christian faith, and by building a city designed to replace this pagan city of Rome. It would be a new capital for his empire. Spending great wealth and robbing many pagan shrines of their statues and columns, Constantine rebuilt the ancient city of Byzantium on a magnificent scale, filled it with beautiful churches, and cleaned it of its pagan past. Called Constantinopolis, or Constantinople, as it's known, the city of Constantine. This city eventually became the seat of the Byzantine Empire and a bastion of Christendom for over 1,000 years, till its fall in the year 1453 at the hands of the Ottoman Turks. At the same time, he began supplying funds for enlarging and rebuilding the churches in all the provinces of the Eastern Empire. That's right now where they're saying in 324 he wrested control of the Eastern Empire, and now he was in a position to help out the Christians and the churches in now what became his enlarged empire. Because of his efforts, Christianity, initially a minority sect, eventually became the official religion of the Roman Empire. So in a sense, when we speak about Christianity and the Roman Catholic Church, the name that comes to mind, first and foremost, is Constantine. Because of him, Christianity became the official religion of Rome. His influence was felt in other ways as well. Believing he was God's chosen servant and responsible for the welfare of the church, he convened what was to become the first of many church ecumenical or universal councils, calling together bishops throughout the empire. A total of 220 bishops convened in the city of Nicaea, in what is today Turkey, under his direction, to resolve the doctrinal controversy between Alexander, the bishop of Alexandria, and one of Alexander's priests, Arius. As a result, they issued at that council what became a basic creed for both the Roman Catholic, or Western Church, and the Orthodox, or Eastern Church, that the Father and the Son, represented by Yeshua, are actually of the same substance. And actually, the Father and the Son are all part of the Godhead. This is Arius, who disagreed with this doctrine. He maintained that there's a real difference, a substantial difference in substance between God and Yeshua, was declared a heretic and banned from the church. And it reminds me of the story of the rabbi and the priest. They were speaking about how one could rise in the hierarchy of the church. And the rabbi was speaking to him, what his plans are within the organization, what he could aspire to. And the rabbi asked him, is it possible that one day that you could become a monsignor, which is the next position just above the parish priest? He says, yeah, that's a possibility. What about bishop? One has to have managerial, skills, administration skills. But it's possible that through the years I could rise to the position of bishop. What about archbishop? Again, it's a large church organization. Very few of those who become priests eventually rise to such heights, but it's a possibility. What about a cardinal? There's only some cardinals, but it's a possibility. What about the pope? There's only one pope, but there's never been an American pope, but it's a possibility. What about God? God, no. Well, one of our boys made it. Besides matters of doctrine, they also issued 20 decisions, or canons, uniform guidelines that would affect the governance of all churches. Other issues were also discussed at Nicaea, but not resolved. This included the issues of a uniform dating of Easter and the celibacy of priests, issues that still divide the Catholic and Orthodox churches to this day. What is ironic is that throughout this whole period, Constantine himself was not considered a real Christian, not having received the Christian sacrament of baptism. It was only at the very end of his life, in the year 337, a few days before his death, that he actually received baptism. Interestingly, the bishop that performed the baptism, Eusebius of Nicomedia, was a follower of the heretic Arius. As a result of his having embraced Christianity and his increasing intolerance towards non-Christians, the Jewish community in Palestine, these were the creators of the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Talmud that was created in Palestine, suffered greatly at the hands of the Romans. The situation became so bad that shortly after the fall of Licinius in 324, who was then the pagan emperor of the Eastern Empire, we find a mass exodus of Torah scholars leaving Israel for the yeshivas in Babylon. An account of this exodus is recorded in the famous letter of Rav Shmiragon, one of the major historical sources for this period. And I quote, "After Rabbah and Rav Yosef," these are going to be the topics of discussion in future lectures, "Abaye and Rava reigned as the heads of the Masifta." Masifta was the rabbinic college. As we're going to explain, a Masifta is not merely a yeshiva. And as we think of terms of a yeshiva as a school where young students or budding scholars come to learn at the feet of the great masters. A Masifta was more than that. It was really a conclave of all the great heads of all the yeshivas throughout the land that would convene twice a year to review. They would have a standard syllabus of study, and together the greatest minds and the greatest teachers with all their students would come together. So that twice a year you would have really the interchange of the totality of Jewish scholarship under one roof. That was the Masifta. At one time, Rabbah was head of the Masifta, Rav Yosef, later Abaye, later Rava. In their times, as we're continuing on with Rav Shmuel going, there were terrible persecutions. The worst one is Shmad, forced conversion, in the land of Israel. You know, it's very important I want you just to appreciate this, what we're saying in this lecture. Generally, when one reads sources of church history, one is reading the Christian version. You know, it's like Churchill was asked what he feels, you know, will history be kind to him? And he says, of course, because the victors write the history. Church history was written by members of the church. What's interesting, and really this is really the thrust of this lecture, is we are studying church history from the viewpoint of the creators of the Talmud. As a result, the study of the Talmud in Israel was seriously diminished. All those scholars in Israel whose original home was Babylon, like Reuven and Rabdimi, returned, but they just couldn't take the pressure. This group was joined by the Nachusei. The Nachusei, by the way, we're going off on the side, but it's an important page or chapter in Jewish history. We tend to think of a Talmud Bavli, a Babylonian Talmud, a Talmud Yerushalmi, a Palestinian Talmud. Two separate works created by two separate groups of scholars. In actuality, this is before the advent of fax machines and telephones, there were actually scholars whose whole function, that they were paid for, that was their whole function, was to relate information from one yeshiva, one group of scholars, to the other, that they would be all, in other words, that they would act, to create as the equivalent of one large yeshiva. So those ideas and insights would be created by one group would be related to the other group, and vice versa. This is not Nachusei. Nachusei means Nachus, to go down. They would go down from Israel, down to Babylon, and back again. These scholars who actually had some roots, at least part of the year they spent in Babylon, when the pressure came, they went back to Babylon and stayed because it was just so difficult to continue on with the persecution that was wrought by the church. In addition, as besides, we quoted to you was the account from Rashi Ragon. Rashi Ragon, familiar, was one of the last of the Gaonim, heads of the yeshiva in Babylon in the 10th century. In addition, so he has a whole history of the whole Talmudic times, including the Gaonic times, all the way to his lifetime. According to the historian Rav Isaac Halevi, many scholars who were Palestinian scholars, Israeli scholars, came to Babylon just to seek temporary asylum and returned when conditions improved somewhat. Again, this goes beyond this lecture. But one of the important principles that the Talmud and the Medrash keep on repeating was that the struggle between Yaakov and Esau, between the two brothers, was the prototype of this continuing struggle that would ensue for all eternity. How did Yaakov, when he was faced with an Esau, a brother, that was about to destroy him, there's 400 men coming to him, what was the first thing that he did? He sent him money. He bribed him. And bribery, in Yiddish, says bribery was what they saw from that story and from their own experience, what was successful and worked. So whatever the Romans those who succeeded them, the church, would say, in other words, but a little money placed in the right hands at the right time did an awful lot. So initially conditions were terrible, but certain well-placed donations at least made life tolerable. The story of Christianity's impact on Jewry during the Talmudic era, as we stated from the viewpoint of the Talmud itself, and the personalities that arose to defend Judaism in this continuing clash of Yaakov and Esau, Jacob and Esau, is the topic of tonight's lecture. In history, there are really two main sources how one derives history. One hand we have what we call the narrative history of a later historian that will gather together traditions and to create a continuing, a readable history. In terms of church history, we find Eusebius. He was the bishop of Caesarea. Was one of the most readable histories that we have. It's a continuing history, and it's a major source of those who want to know church history. One has to really pick up Eusebius. In previous lectures, we have quoted him. Another source is really detective work. You pick up a passage here and a little passage here, and together we have a whole picture. In creating history from the Talmud's view, we don't have a continuous history like Eusebius. But what we're going to do is we're going to have a passage here and a passage there, and hopefully a picture will emerge. In the handouts on the first page, I believe this is a fascinating source, is really, we find the word Notzrim used in the Talmud. Notzrim is similar to the word Nazarene. This is the word for Christians. At least this is how it became to be used in the Middle Ages. There's a discussion in the Talmud which deals with practice in the temple times. In the times of the temple, all of Jewry was divided into 24 clans, 24 large groups. Those groups included Kohanim, Levium, the priests, the Levites, and Yisrael, so the masses of Jewry. Some of those were in Jerusalem, and when their week came, there's 24 groups, 24 weeks. When it was their week, they helped out in the temple. But those Jews who lived too far away couldn't help out. They came to synagogues in their various areas and prayed. And there was a whole prayer service. So while work was done in the temple, and again, we have a cycle of 24 weeks, 24 clans. Part of that clan would be working in the temple, and part of that clan would be outside of Jerusalem and praying. And there was a special Kriyas HaTorah, there was a special recitation of the Torah for these groups. And there was fasting that was done. And they fasted from Monday till Thursday. So Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, they fasted. On Friday, Shabbos, and Sunday, they did not fast. So the Gemara explains, the Talmud explains, that Friday they did not fast because then it would come into Shabbos, at least partially in a state of fasting. They didn't want to do that. Shabbos, of course, they did not fast. One is not allowed to fast on Shabbos. The question is, but why did they not fast on Sunday? And the Talmud offers three explanations. One is, Reish Lakish says, after Shabbos, it's very hard to go from feasting to fasting, just hard on the body. There's neshoma yisera, one feels uplifted on Shabbos, one has the ability to eat more, one is more joyous. It's just hard to make that drastic transition. Rabbi Yochanan, though, offered a historical explanation. This is an explanation was not accepted by the other opinions, and what we see from what we have from church history, from early history, from as it's described in the Acts, it does not seem to be borne out. But one thing certain, though, if it is not totally accurate in terms of early church history, it most certainly is accurate in terms of later church history. Rabbi Yochanan maintained that just two words. Om Rabbi Yochanan Mimnei HaNotzrim, because of the Notzrim, which is why it is because of the Christians. And Rabbi Yochanan's understood that the Christians had tremendous power in Palestine at the time and would look at it as offensive of the day that Sunday, which is their day of festivity, should be a day of fasting. From what we know, from our records of the church, the Christian church was in no position to impose its views on the Jews that early. But what it does reflect is the position of the Christian church when Rabbi Yochanan said these words. Evidently, if there's Christianity was not officially tolerated to the year 313. Rabbi Yochanan died approximately in the year 288, 289. Many years before it was officially tolerated. Yet Rabbi Yochanan would project back in the past, perhaps erroneously, and say that the Christians had so much power that the Jews would not be allowed to declare a fast day. And as I repeat before, there's a disagreement within the Talmud itself, and there are others who take issue with it. As we see from the history that we know of the church, it doesn't seem that what we know that the conditions bear that out, but evidently it was indicative of the conditions in Rabbi Yochanan's time. The Christians had a tremendous influence. And again, I think this is fascinating because really this is from a very Jewish source. And it's not, we would say perhaps something which is written in church history would be very, would have a very parochial view, a propagandist view. Now, this is the Jewish view. And evidently the church had tremendous, well, I'll leave after, so looking at questions I've had tremendous power during this time. The next pastors, again, I want to show the would be called the one is, we see the first passage, their power. The second is how pervasive they were. The Gemara makes a makes a comment regarding an opinion that's mentioned in the Mishnah, the opinion of Rabbi Yishmael. One is not allowed, according to the Mishnah, to deal business with pagans right before a pagan holiday because of the fear of it would add to their festivities. You can't loan them money. You can't sell them objects that could be used theoretically for their sacrifices, for their festivities. Not only does it apply in the fast day itself, but at least in the land of Israel, applies 3 days before. Rabbi Yishmael made the comment, not does it apply just 3 days before, but 3 days afterwards as well. Based on the opinion of Rabbi Yishmael, it's 3 days before, then the day, then 3 days afterwards, he says, well, says, according to Rabbi Yishmael, it is always forbidden to transact business with idolaters because of Sunday. This is the quote. The group that we know is historically that celebrated Sunday was the Christians. And two things we see, that it was widespread. I mean, he's not speaking, probably he would not be commenting on some minor fringe group that was being persecuted and only did this in private. He was dealing with a group that did this publicly and was quite widespread and large. Secondly, we see, which seems to be an opinion which it would seem to be the majority, at least the early commentators maintain, that they looked at Christianity as a form of idolatry. Because the belief in the Father and the Son, this dualism, and later on, as we're going to explain, the Trinity, is looked as really the Godhead was really a form, a metamorphized form of paganism, polytheism. This goes beyond this lecture, but it is really amazing. One goes through early Egyptian history, and one sees from the pagan records of what we know, from the book, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, from the early dynasties, there was much monotheism in their paganism. It wasn't as we would look that it's just all things. They really worshiped the God who was the creator of heaven and earth, who metamorphized himself into different forms. The Father and the Son, which really fits into this, would be this, this pagan paradigm of a Godhead. And again, the mystery of how are you, how is it parts, how is it one, and how does one look at this, is really very much part of the pagan paradigm. For those who are just not familiar with this, it is why Sunday is so important in Christian belief. Why is Sunday the holy day? Is because that was the day of the, purportedly this was the day of the resurrection, that he rose from the dead. It was his rising from the dead which was really the sign of the validity of Christianity, his eternal life, and this was celebrated, at least from the earliest times, as a special day. So on one hand, again, from these two sources, we see their power, how widespread they are, and also how the sages of the Talmud viewed them. They view them as idolaters, as a form of idolatry. Even though amongst other religions, I mean pre-Muslim religions, it was the closest to Judaism. A fascinating chapter here in Jewish-Christian relations, which from my own readings, it looks really as a novelty, which we don't see in other histories, is the disputations, is how the Christian church and the Jews were constantly arguing. And we're going to be forced to argue by the Roman government. We know there's a famous disputation, I believe, with Justinian Martyr and Tryphon. But it wasn't just the disputation is not just a single event. It was a constant, ongoing thing that Christians, and Jews, Jewish scholars and Christian scholars were constantly debating. The source I have of Yeshua ben Hananya is approximately in the year 120. And Yeshua ben Hananya was at the court of Caesar. A certain heretic showed him by gestures a people whose Lord had turned his face from them. One of the central tenets of Christianity is that Judaism has been superseded by Christianity. And the covenant that was originally made to the Jews is no longer valid. The Jews have not accepted, this is what would be called the culmination of their faith. And therefore, the Jews are suffering. And they view all the cumulative suffering of the Jews from the end of the Second Temple period on is a result of the Jews having rejected, says the Yeshua, the founder of Christianity. So a heretic showed, this was in the presence of Caesar. And this was a time when Christianity itself was really outlawed. And it seems that he pitted one, again, I'm saying this in the absence of any other sources, just the sources seem to say that he kept on pitting one against the other. Like basically that he didn't hold of either. But he wants basically to wear them down, and as each one should see the fallacy of their way, what he wanted was the elimination of both Christianity and Judaism. So this heretic went and made a gesture, says, this is a people that the Lord has turned his face from them. Rabbi Yeshua in turn made a gesture to say, says, his hand is still stretched over us. He's taking care of us. The emperor didn't exactly understand what was going on with these gestures. And he asked Rabbi Yeshua, he says, what did you say? What went on here? So he explained the meaning of the gesture of the heretic. In other words, of this, we call here, this is Christian. He says that God has rejected the Jews. And he explained his gesture, says, there was a pantomime. This is just a gesture that God is still taking care of the Jews. He then turned to the heretic and he said, what did you say? And he said, what did your gesture mean? He said it just like Rabbi Yeshua had interpreted. He said, what did the rabbi mean? He didn't know. He says, you don't know? In other words, you're not adept at gesturing. Evidently it was a kunst, it was pantomime. Says, you know, this is, you know, under the, you know, in front of the you know, in front of Caesar, you know, it's no, you know, it was made people who are adept at what they're doing. You know, this is for professionals. And he felt that someone who doesn't know and is just showing off really does not, is really an affront for such a person to be performing in front of the Caesar. And he had him killed. As he said, they led him forth and slew him. We've discussed this in a previous lecture, went through the life story of Rabbi Yeshua. And as I commented then, that evidently from this story we see it was an amateur's night at Caesar's palace. The idea of these debates really is something which flows throughout the Talmud. And again, if you put it to page 2, there was a place called Bei Avidon. And it's not clear what the Bei Avidon means. Later commentaries really don't know. Some say it's just a euphemism. Avidon is where Aveda means may it be destroyed. But it was a place of debates of Christians and Jews. In fact, the emperor asked Rabbi Yeshua, this is Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya, says, why don't you attend it on a regular basis? Why don't you go there? And he kept on giving excuses. He says, I'm old. The mountain is snowy. In other words, my head is white. He says, it's covered, surrounded by ice. He says on page 2, he says, the beard is white. It's surrounded by ice. The dog does not bark. In other words, my voice already, I can't talk on the same level. And the grinders do not grind. He says, I can't chew. He says, it's difficult for me to go around. I don't have the strength to attend these debates. When Elazar ben Prata, who was taken in, this was after the defeat, the historians, this is after the Bar Kokhba wars. And they took him in, and their question to him is, why didn't you go to the Beis Avidan? Why didn't you go to the place of the debates? Evidently it was something mandatory that they wanted the Jews to enter these debates with these Christians. One indication of the feelings that Christians, the Jews had towards these Christians, because they're the thrust of what they wanted to do is what they wanted to do from time immemorial to this day, is to convert the Jews. And the question is, what happens if you have a Sefer Torah that is written by one of these Christian missionaries? And Rabbi Tarfon says it should be burned. And as you look at the notes on page 2, there's a whole thing of justification that it should be burned because it causes, really, it undermines the Jewish faith. There was a question at the top of page 3. What happens if you find a Sefer Torah from Beis Avidan? You know, as you find it from this place of debate. And there wasn't sure, should you burn it or not? Because maybe it was written by a kosher scribe and it was bought for use. But they used to take out these scrolls and use them in the debates. And it was the equivalent of taking out a Bible, you know, and verse this. They would take out a Sefer Torah. To the extent that the question was, well, could you burn it? So maybe not. It was a kosher. They just purchased it. It was written by a kosher scribe. On page 3, in the second paragraph, I think which is very noteworthy. This last paragraph is taken from the Talmud that has been censored. This is from that same thing in 116a. Except if you look in a standard Talmud, you won't find this. And this is Rabbi Meir, one of the great Tanoim writers of the Mishnah, authors of the Mishnah, Rabbi Yochanan, one of the great authors of the Talmud, describing what they felt of the Gospels, the evangelical writings. And a play on word, he says, this is Avon Gilion, this is evangelical, is learned from Oven, which is Olivov, which is falsehood. Gilionis is false, is blank paper. And they were just poking fun at the Gospels. Rabbi Yochanan says Oven, he pronounced with an ayin, which means sin. But one thing it tells you was the amount of missionary activity that they would even bother to comment about the Gospels. You take a rabbi today, or a yeshiva bocher today, they don't know of its existence, let alone that they're going to go and make some comment about it. We're so far removed from it. In those days, it seems the Christian church was busy with missionary activities, to the extent that we have quotes from the rabbis just as one-liners, you know, about what their view of it. But it was material that they were familiar with because this was the material that the missionaries were constantly trying to persuade Jews to forsake their Judaism. I just think it's just fascinating. Again, we're just taking bits and pieces to construct, you know, basically a history from the Jewish perspective. On paragraph E, I found it was also a fascinating quote, which I didn't see any of the commentators deal with. Rav Chiya Bar Abba, which we mentioned in the last lecture, he was a disciple of Rabbi Yochanan. There's a quote here from the Psikta. Psikta was a midrash was written in Talmudic times. He says, Im yomer loch brod zanisa, if the son of the adulterous woman says to you, says, train, says Elohim Inun, there are two gods. So he says, tell him, it says, Anochi, he says, when by Mount Sinai, he says, Anochi Hashem Elokech, I, and there's the word Ani, which is I, Anochi, which is I. Anochi means I and only I. It's stressed, it's just me, same one. What I found as fascinating is two things. First of all, it would seem, and I don't see, but it seems obvious, that Broad as Anissa, the son of the adulterous woman, is an allusion to Yeshu himself. Which really just gives you indicative of how, what they felt about his origins. I think it's just obvious. The second is, which again from church history, is in the Talmud we only find the idea of two gods. There's a question, is there one God or two gods? We don't find the Trinity. We don't find three gods. We don't find the Holy Ghost, the Holy Spirit, as an equal. There's only two. It's only later on in the Council of Constantinople, in the year 381, that officially the doctrine of Trinity was adopted of three. But in Talmudic sources, which is some 100 years before the Council of Constantinople, we only know of two gods. Which I think just, again, from church history, I think it's fascinating. We're going to skip this section, but I think you should look at it yourself. The disputations and the proofs, which are full, we have in church literature, and which is quoted by every missionary. Those kinds of proofs are offered, really, we find in the Talmud. And again, the force of the proof was different than what we encounter from the passages which are quoted at missionaries. Basically, they are to prove that the predictions that were meant for the Messiah was fulfilled in Jesus of Nazareth. Here, the stress is, are there two gods or one? Again, it's all the same. Really, it runs all to the same. That really the question is, are there two or one? And let me just end this section with just two comments. One is it's just important, again, from an historical viewpoint to realize, why was it so important from a Christian viewpoint that there be two gods? I mean, why doesn't it suffice to say that Jesus of Nazareth, the historical figure, was the promised Messiah, as he's the Mashiach? Fine. There were no claims of divinity for Moshe, for Moses. Why are there claims of divinity for Mashiach, the Messiah? The Christian Messiah, it's very important to realize, is very different than the traditional Jewish view of the Messiah. The traditional Jewish view of the Mashiach is this heir to the throne of David, of David HaMelech, who will lead the Jews, inspire the Jews, usher in an age of unprecedented peace and spirituality. Jesus of Nazareth died in a time when the Jews were persecuted, did not bring peace to this world. Untold suffering has occurred for the last some 2,000 years, from his birth. What did he do? I mean, there's really nothing that can be pointed to historically the Jesus of Nazareth did for not only the Jewish people, for the world at large. The Golos Shigaton, like, what did he do? It's like the saying, if when you're stuck with a lemon, you make lemonade. Jesus of Nazareth was repackaged by one of the slickest groups of the precursors of Madison Avenue. And he was given a whole new identity. And a whole new purpose, a function, that Jews really were not even aware of until his disciples came and created this new theology. And the theology is that all of man is burdened with sin. A sin that they were all forced to suffer with. And this is the original sin of Adam and Chava, of Adam and Eve, that all of mankind are burdened with. And the only way to get rid of this sin is to bring a sacrifice, but not an animal sacrifice, the ultimate sacrifice. And here Jesus of Nazareth became the ultimate sacrifice, that those who believe, who stell sich zu, in other words, who become part of this sacrifice, will get the atonement. And those who don't will be burdened with this sin. So the function of Jesus became that of the great atoner. And his death created atonement for our sins. But the question is, why him then? Why should, I mean, we don't believe in human sacrifice. I mean, why take one person? He has to have all this suffering, and he should be the one to be the cause of all this atonement. And hence, really, this is a corollary of this. No, he wasn't just a simple person. He was the Son of God. And this was something which, at least in the New Testament, and we have in the Gospels, we find that him making such a claim as the Son of God. Well, if he's the Son of God, he's not just a regular sacrifice. This becomes a really, what we're dealing then with this metaphysical process, which is created by part of the Godhead himself. So it's not just taking a human. You know, we need volunteers, you know. You know, it's like, you know, the platoon in the army, you know. We need volunteers, you know, to take out this sniper's nest. And everybody steps back except one guy. You know, he's our volunteer, you know. He wasn't just a volunteer. He was the one who was created, or was part from time immemorial, to be part of this drama. And what happened was that this sacrifice and this suffering was really done by part of God to atone for humanity. And hence Jesus is just a historical figure, but really part of the Godhead. He is the Son of God, and as we say in this part of the Nicene Creed, he is really God himself. So part of God goes through this whole process of suffering to atone for mankind. And of course, but only those who believe in it will be so atoned. So it was very important for them to give him the status of God. Because if he's not God, and he's just a simple person, why should his sacrifice, I mean, he's not the Messiah in the normal sense, he didn't create any great political revolutions, why should this humble man be responsible for all this atonement? So hence, he's not a humble person, he's not just a simple human being, he is part of God himself. And then there are two functions. There's the Father, and then the Son. The Son is the one who grants grace. He's the one who grants atonement. And this is why this point is the one that was so hotly debated. And Christians wanted to find allusions in Scripture itself to point to, no, there are two, not one. Finally, I'd like to tell you just a little story. Of the priest of this town who called the Jews to a debate. And the Jews, realizing what was at stake, were very hard pressed, and they were really not familiar. I mean, these are Jews who are steeped in the study of Talmud and of Tanakh, of the Hebrew Bible, but know very little of Christian literature, and felt very ill at ease to defend themselves against the charges or the proofs that would be brought against them. And when the rabbis were debating who would be the representative of the Jews, a simple Jew from out in the countryside volunteers, says, "I'll be the representative." He says, "I know," says, "I'll be able to." And they didn't know, should they take him or shouldn't, but he was so confident, they decided that he would enter the debate. So he the if I have the story, I'm missing part of it, but I think it's just very cute. The village priest then, just like the story with the gestures that would be made, says, went and stuck out his two fingers. This was the first thing. And the villager stuck out one finger. And the priest stuck out his open hand, and the Jew says, so with a fist. Says the priest went and took a clump of rice or wheat and threw it on the floor, and the Jew went on the floor and picked it all up, and the priest admitted defeat. And they asked the priest, says, what was this all about? What did you mean to say? Says, I stuck my two fingers and I says, there are two gods. And he said, no, there's only one. I put my hand out to show the five separate fingers. There are many parts of God. Says, and he said, he stuck his thing, his fist, no, there's only one. Says, and I took the rice and I threw it out to show how the Jews were dispersed. Says, and he went and took the rice and picked it all up to show, says, no, the Jews will eventually be gathered together again. So they asked the villager, says, how did you understand what was happening? So he says, he took his two fingers, says, I'm going to poke both of your eyes out. He says, now I took my one, I could do it with one hand, with one finger, I could point, pick your eyes. He says, he took his hand out to slap me, and I took my fist, you're going to get it. He says, and when he threw that rice out, so like this, says, I know from my mother, we don't throw away food, so I picked it up. Another theme of all these debates, which came from the Roman bias rather than the Christian bias, was the assimilation of the Jews. The Jews stuck out. They just didn't fit in. A beautiful story is related on page 5 here. The emperor asked Rabbi Tanhum, he says, come, let us be one people. Why does there have to be division between Jew and Gentile? And Rabbi Tanhum says, that's a great idea, but we're circumcised already, so we can't do anything about it. You be circumcised too, and you'll join us. The emperor said, you know, that was a great, you know, you really answered me well. He says, but we have a rule that anyone who has the better of the king in a debate is put to death. They really have a way, these Romans. So they took Rabbi Tanhum and threw him into this vivarium. This is like full of, like it's Daniel in the lion's den. They threw him into this whole, you know, this whole group of wild animals. And nothing happened to him. So they took him out. So a heretic, referring to a Christian, said, the reason they didn't eat him out because he's not hungry. So they wanted to try it out. They threw him, the heretic, in there instead, and he was devoured. But one thing this little story tells you was the pressure that existed that the Jews should be assimilated. And I'd like to end this section just with a beautiful story here. This is taken from the Psikta of the Rabbi Kahana, and I think it's really something that we should all take to heart. But before they say, let's just summarize what we have till this point. We started off with the struggle of Jacob and Esau, so the two brothers, that eventually started from the kingdom of Edomia, of Edom in the south. Eventually the Edomians did control the Jews. This was Herod and his dynasty created. There was the Romans, who were also, according to the Talmud, descendants of Esau, who ruled over the Jews and created a religion that in turn ruled over the Jews up until this time. We dealt with the ongoing debates and hard feelings and the difficulties that the Jews had to live in a Christian world. The attempts to convert them, the attempts to assimilate them. And we end off here with this passage. I'd like to read it to you. You can follow here. The nations of the world try to influence the Jews by telling them, how long are you going to die for your God and be murdered and give up your life for him? So many punishments does he bring upon you. How much is looted from you? How many nations does he bring upon you? Return unto us and we will make you the highest officers and men of power. In other words, basically they're saying, the Jews have suffered so much. Wouldn't it be easier to become a non-Jew? How well you'll be accepted. You know, one of the great and the famous converts in 19th century Russia was Daniil Chavolson, who was of sorts a Talmud Chacham, and he had learned in yeshivas, or he was well learned, and he eventually be converted to Russian Orthodoxy, and had a position, I think, as professor of Oriental studies in the University of St. Petersburg. And they asked him, so why did you convert? So he says, it's so much easier to have the power and prestige of a full professorship in St. Petersburg than being a Melamed in a little village, just being a village teacher. But there, fortunately, there were not many like that. And most Jews did not succumb to the pressures and the lure of non-Jewish society, at least in that period of time. And the Jews, it continues on the Medrash, enter their synagogues and houses of learning and open up the Sefer Torah and read. And I will turn my face unto you. This is what will happen in Mashiach's times. And in the Messianic era, I'll multiply you. I'll place my dwelling place in your midst and my spirit will no longer reject you. And they become consoled. They know there's going to be a better day for the Jewish people. In the future, when the end of days will come, the Holy One, blessed be He, will ask the Jews, I am puzzled, how did you wait for me all those years? This is an amazing passage. It says, how did you have the courage, the strength of character, to withstand all that pressure and remain loyal to me? And the people of Israel reply, had it not been for your Torah, which you wrote for us, the nations of the world would have long taken us away from you. In other words, we gain the strength from the Torah, from learning the Torah. That strength supported us. Perhaps we could understand today that probably the major reason that there is so much defection from the Jewish community is because the lack of our knowledge of Torah. It was because we studied Torah, we were inspired by it, that we remained loyal. Unfortunately, our educational system, for the most part, is so poor that the average Jew knows very little about what Judaism is, what our history is, and when they are given the choice of being accepted, it's very hard to counter it because they have no knowledge and no inspiration to go counter to all the lures of the greater society. I would just briefly like to give you to paint a picture of one of the great leaders of Jewry, a disciple of Rabbi Yochanan, the great teacher of the Talmud Yerushalmi, who at that time was the major defender of the Jewish people. He is described, and let's just briefly go over, I want you to see from the sources itself what kind of a person he was. In the first, this is page 6 in paragraph A, describing Rabbi Yabol as a person who is adept at scripture, adept at Mishnah, one who fears God is best typified. They could find one person who was so well-rounded was this Rebbe Abohu. And not only was he adept at Torah, he appreciated the Torah. You know, in the davening, in the prayers we say at Ma'ariv, we ask, V'nismach b'divrei salma Torah sefer. Let us rejoice. Give us the insight to rejoice in your learning. There's a whole story, again, when they looked at Rabbi Abohu as unique, the joy that he had from learning. He was the Rav, he was the Mor d'Asra, he was the leader of the Jewish community in Caesarea, which was the seat of the Roman government in Palestine. That which we blow the shofar, you know, by the way, you know, we blow the shofar in three forms on Rosh Hashanah. You know, there's the tkiah, there's the shvorim trua, then the tkiah. We have the tkiah, the shvorim, and then just the trua. You know, the moan and the staccato, and we have them separate, we have them together. That is a result of the ruling of Rabbi Abohu. So every time on Rosh Hashanah you hear it, remember Rabbi Abohu. But besides his great accomplishments, his scholarship, you know, his joy was his humility. And I'd like to read, this is a classic here on page 7. Rabbi Abohu also said, At first I used to think that I was humble. He looked at himself as a person who didn't run after honors, a person who respected other people. But when I saw Rabbi Abba of Akko, and I said, you know, in the yeshivas, and this is a point which we're going to through the history of the Talmud, when they used to give lectures, the Rosh Yeshiva, the lecturer, the head of the yeshiva, would in a subdued voice would whisper to his miturgamon, the one who would take what he would say, and with a loud voice, this is before the advent of speaker systems, would teach this to throngs of students. In some yeshivas, there were many of these people, you know, that they would first consult with the Rosh Yeshiva, would tell them what to say, then they would get up and give explanations to various groups of students. Rabbi Abba, a Rosh Yeshiva, head of a yeshiva, these are people who were scholars, but not of the rank of Rosh Yeshiva. They would give their insights. The person would understand it, and then get up in a booming voice and project it to the multitude. Well, Rabbi Abba would tell his amora, this person, the one with the loud voice, what to say. The amora said, I have a better shot. And he would get up and say what he would have a better, what he considered to deem a better explanation. And Rabbi Abba would tell him one thing, and he would get up and say something else. And Rabbi Abba didn't make a fuss about this. He says, such a person, says, even I would fire the person and get somebody else. He didn't. Says the Gemara continues on. So Rabbi Abba was amazed at Rabbi Abba's humility. But it's evident Rabbi Abba was quite a humble person himself. Says, how did Rabbi Abba display humility? Says the wife of Rabbi Abba's amora. Says his the amora was the one who was the one with the loud voice. Said to Rabbi Abba's wife, you know, my husband has no need of instruction from your husband. You know, he really knows it all. And when he bends down, you know, to listen to what Rabbi Abba has to say and straightens up, he merely pays him respect. He could have done it himself. That's the wife of the Amora, in other words, the loudspeaker. Rabbi Abba's wife went and, you know, she took offense and told her husband. So he says, so Rabbi Abba says, what does it bother you for? So he says, what's the difference if whether it's through me, whether it's through him, the Amor? He says, Yiskalos is Yiskalos Eloi. He says, the all highest is praised. But The important thing is the students get the message. What difference is it? Does it bother you that if he could do it himself or I do it? The important thing is not the one who takes credit for it. The important thing is the students know the material. And he was in fact, Rabbi Abo was such as that when they wanted to appoint him as Rosh Yeshiva, and according to historians, we went last week, we went through previous lectures, we spoke about Rabbi Yochanan, we spoke about Rabbi Elazar, we spoke about Rabbi Ami. Rabbi Ami died, and by the time Rabbi Ami died, the yeshiva, because of Christian pressure, had moved to Caesarea to be by Rabbi Abo and under his protection, because he had a tremendous good relations with the Roman authorities. And where Rabbi Ami died, they wanted to appoint Rabbi Abohu to this position, but he refused. He says, how could I take this position? There's Rabbi Abba of Akko. So like this, and he needs the money more than I. You know, he needs the position. I don't need the money. Besides his tremendous scholarship, as we alluded to before, he had tremendous influence in the house of Caesar, of Caesar's representative in Palestine. And here on page 8, the Talmud refers to Rabbi Abo as one of the great people. They want to say people of influence. So they pointed to Rabbi Abo as it would be the paradigm of a person, of the prototype of someone who has influence in the court. In fact, in paragraph B, it says here on page 8, where Abo came from the yeshiva to the court of the emperor. He went out of the yeshiva and went to the governmental offices in Caesarea. Handmaids from the imperial house were so taken by him. They would sing his praises, prince of his people, leader of his nation, shining light, blessed be thy coming in peace. He was not only articulate, brilliant, he was beautiful as well. He was amazingly handsome. And this is in paragraph C. That it mentions is that Rabbi Abo was a reflection of the beauty of Yaakov Avinu, of our father Jacob. Yaakov's beauty was reflection of Adam's, of the first man's. But they looked at him as a person who was a striking-looking person. And because of that, the governmental officials had tremendous respect for him, not just his wisdom, but for his outward looks. You know, there are all kinds of studies that made the people that are perceived to be better-looking are also perceived to have all kinds of talents that really they don't have. But and if you do have those talents, most certainly it's a benefit. Besides his positive influence in the court of Caesar, besides his contribution to collective Jewish learning, because throughout the Talmud we have his teachings, Rabbi Abo's. He was a formidable opponent of the early Christian church. And just interesting, and again I'm quoting from the Talmud Yerushalmi, is on page 9, in paragraph A. Rabbi Abo said, if someone tells you I am God, he is a liar. If he tells you I am the saintly son of man, the end will be that you will be disappointed in him. Because if people make claims about themselves, don't accept them. If he tells you I'm going to rise to heaven, he is just talking and will not fulfill it. And to me it seems clearly an allusion to the Christian claims. Because Rabbi Abo also said in addition, and this is in the Medrash, again, I am the Lord your God. He says, I am first, he says, and he quotes a pasuk in Isaiah, I have no father, I have no son, I have no brother. There's only one God. You can, on your own, since the time doesn't last, is on page 10, there's a beautiful little story taken from the Gemara in Avodah Zorah on 4a and Dalet Amud Aleph. About the relations that Rabbi Abo had with the Minim. Again, this was pre-Constantine Palestine. Rabbi Yabou died approximately the year 300. The Milan Decree is 313. Even if we'd say that he lived, you know, close to this time, it seems that there were pockets where they had tremendous influence even from before. But they did not easily accept the influence that he had. And on the bottom of page 10, we quote a Gemara in Avodah Zorah, that Rabbi Yabou had a Christian doctor who gave him medicine for an illness which was actually an acid that was burning into his leg. And his students had to lick it off, or, you know, to rub it off. And even though this physician jeopardized his position, but he was willing to do so because he felt that Rabbi Yabou was such a menace to the survival of the Christian church. And I'd like to end off here on page 11 with something which goes beyond this subject itself. Rabbi Yabou, as we described, was a person who was God-fearing, a person of a great scholar who mastered all segments of Jewish learning, a person who was well respected by the government and a powerful antagonist of the early Christian church. One fascinating story which is preserved in the Talmud Yerushalmi, and it gives us an idea of his spirituality. When Rabbi Yabou died, he saw a vision of 13 rivers of Afarsamon. Afarsamon was a rare fragrant oil, appeared to flow before him. And he said to God, or to the Shekhinah, says, who are these four? And he replies, it's for you. And he said, all of this for me? And it was like, it was a vision of the spiritual splendor, that which was awaiting for him in the other world. He says, all of this for this? And I thought, says, for naught did I labor. I looked at myself that my accomplishments were very few in life. I wasn't worthy of this. It comes as a pleasant surprise. And it goes on the Talmud to explain the idea that very often we are given a taste of the world to come, or at least saintly people, before they die, so that to make the transition all the more sweeter. And it's interesting the parallel to this with those who claim to have near-death experiences, who have this out-of-body experience and claim to go to paradise and to experience something which is beyond words. And for whatever reason, they come back, because it wasn't really the time for them to leave this world. They come back with tremendous reluctance because of the beauty of the vision of the next world. And it's just very interesting to find the parallel in Jewish sources to the idea of the near-death experience and the idea of that one is given with a preview of the future to make the transition all the more easier. And perhaps I just leave off with the following story. Many of you have heard this in a previous lecture. I think it's just a great story. I think we'll finish the lecture on this note. The story goes that David Ben-Gurion, before he died, had a dream. And in that dream, he went up to heaven. He had died. He saw himself going through death, going up to heaven, going before the divine tribunal. And the group, because there were three great sages, spoke to him and said, since you are the prime minister of Israel, we are going to offer to you something that has never been offered before. We are going to let you choose if you want to go to heaven or to the other place. Ben Gurion is a very smart man. He says, please show me. You know, I'm from Missouri. So for they take him to heaven, and it's one big yeshiva. And they're learning and they're studying. So I've seen enough. Show me the other place. And he goes, to the other place, and it's just wonderful. Music and eating and drinking and pleasures of all sorts. And with a smile on his face, he woke up. 3 weeks to the day, Ben-Gurion dies. And that scene that he had seen in his dream as unfolds before his very eyes. And he is brought to the divine tribunal, and the three sages that he saw in his dream sit before him. And the same speech that since he was the prime minister of Israel, he'll be afforded an honor that was never afforded to anyone else. That he himself can choose whether he wants to go to heaven or the other place. At this point, he doesn't need to ask to be shown. Without reservation, he says, I want to go to the other place. And he goes, and it's hot. And it's terrible, and they're screaming, and it's dark, and it's... And he turns to his angel guide, and he says, wait a minute. This wasn't this place that they showed me before. And he thought for a moment, then the angel laughed, huh, that's probably the place they show the tourists. Are there any questions?
When did the church officially make Sunday year of the Sabbath?
It seems very early on. It's just, there is a question about the change. Was Sabbath still Sabbath? In other words, did they celebrate 2 days? Was there the Sabbath and there was a Sunday? I guess it was tough in those days to have a 2-day weekend, so they cut down to 6-day work week and they switched it off to Sunday. But it's not very clear what the sources are, but it seems from here Shmuel died in the year 253. He is referring to what would be a common phenomenon in his time. That evidently that Sunday was viewed as a pagan holiday and would have all the laws that would apply to it. This is really relatively early on. But I don't know if we do really have documentation as to when the change actually occurred. The idea of why they're so interested in the basic religion, we can only theorize because really this is all we have. My suspicion is that it was really to annul both of them. It was really a win-win situation. Christianity was a serious threat to the old order in the Roman Empire. Jews really were not. They were a self-contained group. Christianity was a missionary religion. It was busy proselytizing the masses, creating within a new ethic, which is really undermining the old order. In the time of Trajan, the one who was the emperor before Hadrian, probably the emperor, Hadrian was probably the emperor that Rabbi Yeshua dealt with, we have letters from Pliny the Younger to Trajan about how Pliny the Younger was trying to torture the Christians. He was the governor of the province of Bithynia, which is in Turkey. Because they looked at it as really was undermining it was undermining their whole country. So it was important on one hand for the Christians to be convinced that, you know, that really they really have no, you know, that really it's not the genuine article. And perhaps at least if they would be so convinced that they would abandon Christianity and become ultimately mainstream. The other side, however, is if the Jews abandon Judaism, it's also a win-win situation. And it's because they looked as the Jews as a thorn in their side. So I feel that really they promoted this because only the Romans could win out in such a debate. Yes.
I think the thorn occurred
It's the idea of the number of Jews is really not, again, it's really not that clear. From one history that I saw, they had the population was an eighth, like some 12%. So it's very difficult. It's really difficult. We don't have really, really hard and fast numbers. Yeah, there were a lot of Jews. And the Jews, they felt, also had at least, there was a certain attraction that Jewishness had as well. We know at least the last source that we have of this, we have from Josephus, describes how what were formerly pagans or non-Jews would adopt Jewish practices of Shabbos and other things, even though they didn't totally adopt Judaism. So it had a certain attraction, which again, they felt undermined, like it had an undermining influence. On the other hand, as well, because of the revolts that occurred at the end of the time of Trajan, and later the time of Hadrian, they were afraid that Jews were creating this independence movement. They just were not, falling into line. So nationally, it was important to demoralize them as well. So it was a win-win situation for them. Yes. The Constantine, yes. What I believe, and I'm not sure about the histories, was I don't think that the practice of paganism was outlawed. It was discouraged. When you plunder all the pagan temples, you take all their monies, and Christianity is promoted, and anyone in an official position only gets a job because he's a Christian, there's a certain bias that's created that encourages this. Eventually, paganism was outlawed and they were forcibly converted. But that didn't occur in Constantine's time. Yeah. Yes. The question is about that the Jews were impugned for killing for killing the founder of their faith. It seems from the early we have from the letters of Paul and from the early Christians that there is much there which is really forms the basis of this tremendous guilt and hatred that the Jews were the ones who were responsible, they were the ones who rejected him, and that's why they were ultimately rejected, and for this theology that now all those that embrace Jesus are the chosen people. Early on in their literature, the Jews were blamed for this. It's true, this is all part of the divine plan, but that they have free choice. And they ultimately had free choice to dissociate themselves from those who perpetrated his death. And those who still fail to believe are really those who condone that death and are held responsible. Really, it was only until Vatican II that officially, the 1960s, that they officially took the stance that Jews are no longer responsible. That's an awful long time. But they maintain that the Jews really are. I mean, ultimately, what's ironic is the Romans, who actually did kill them, were not given anywhere near the hatred. I mean, that the Jews really only were indirectly responsible, according to the accounts in the New Testament, that they gave them over to the Romans. Well, the Romans were actually the ones that killed them, and the Romans were always looked at, with the most considerate eyes. But it seems very early on this negative attitude towards Jews was created by the church. This is very, just in the psychology of groups, and especially splinter groups, it's all those who are so close to that other group, you know, but have veered off for this reason or that reason, and anything, tend to demonize the other groups just to assert their own special place. We find it in the communist movement. You would think of reading the Bolshevik literature, the Mensheviks are the worst people that, are worse than capitalists, the Chas v'Sholom, but it's all part of this. When there's a schism, and those who tend to be a little different stake out their position of superiority and demonize the others. It's part of a general process.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.